Welcome to the Law and Guidance Podcast with me, Sally Penny, MBE. Today I've got a brilliant guest here, Dr. Kath White, OBE, who is the head of St. Mary's SARC in Manchester. I'll let her introduce herself for me. But we're talking here about non-fatal strangulation, and I'm delighted to have a true expert.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kath White, Clinical Director of St. Mary's SARC in Manchester.
Brilliant. Thank you, Kath. Kath, I've been wanting to get you on for some time, but I want, for various reasons really, to talk about not just sexual offences, which we're not going to talk about strictly today, the offences under the Act, but we're talking today about non-fatal strangulation and the new bill which the government has introduced, so there'll be a maximum of 5 years. Can we start from the beginning? Why have you been a campaigner? Because I remember a lunchtime lecture you gave, bar and to judges, at Manchester Civil Centre, which was excellent. And you have been one of the advocates, as I have, that there ought to be an increase in sentence. So I wonder, where did that come from? Why have you been so interested to push for change in the law so far as non-fatal strangulation is concerned?
Well, 2016, somebody shared an article with me, a research paper, a Nancy Glass paper from America, and said, you know, I think you might be interested in this. And I read it, and it was, I thought it was a very good paper. But basically, the take-home message was that non-fatal strangulation is important, and it's an important risk factor for future homicide of women. So if you had a history of non-fatal strangulation, in other words, someone had strangled you but hadn't managed to kill you, yes, you were 6 times the risk of becoming a victim of attempted homicide in the future and 7 times the risk of becoming a completed homicide in the future, which was quite staggering, really.
Yes.
So that got me thinking, well, that's Baltimore over in America. What's actually going on here in the UK? And I started looking at it, and I actually couldn't find much. You know, I approached the Home Office for statistics. I spoke to the police. I spoke to coroners, and I couldn't find those kind of statistics, which surprised me. In the end, I was pointed in the direction of the femicide census, which, you know, your listeners may have heard of, Karen Ingala Smith. And with that, so the version back then was showing a quarter of women were strangled, but I was trying to think, well, it's too late once they're dead. What can we look at that might highlight to us risk so that we can prevent future homicides? And then, you know, the St. Mary's pro forma has had something about strangulation, you know, more or less like a little tick box for a long time. But we never really, you know, if they said they'd been strangled, we'd tick it and that was it. And I started thinking, well, should we be doing more about this? And I was speaking to people in the criminal justice system, to barristers, CPS, judges, and very few of them had ever seen the law on strangulation ever being utilised. And so it just really got me thinking, we've got to be collectively doing better here. And so it started me on that journey.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because there are other offences. This is often the argument, isn't it, that we use. You know, so you might just use offences under the Offence Against a Persons Act. You might use a Section 47 assault. You might use a Section 18. You know, there are other offences that you would use. And so the argument actually was, because, you know, lots of lawyers, people phone me up all the time. Oh, I'm thinking of charging this, or what do you think about this? I've got a client who's charged. So we don't actually ever deal with it specifically. But when you look at the rates, as you've quoted, which are staggering, you know, we've been in a pandemic and we've seen the huge rise in domestic violence and violence against women in that period. It's not a surprise, is it? But interesting that you went to the Femicide Centre, and perhaps, you know, people not listening won't know what St. Mary's SARC is. It's the Sexual Assault Referral Centre in Manchester, and there are lots of them around different parts of the country. And when you talked about the form, are you talking about when you have complainants or victims come to the centre, you're able to record it in such a way so you've got data?
Yeah, so we have a pro forma, and so when we're seeing somebody for a forensic medical examination, it's an aid memoir for us taking the history. But with the strangulation, as I said, you know, it was just a tick box. We wouldn't really go explore it any further, and we weren't proactively asking. And what was really interesting is, so back in 2016, you know, I read this paper and I'm thinking we've got to be doing more. And I started looking around and came across the Institute for the Prevention of Strangulation over in America. And I actually took myself off to Texas for a 4-day course on strangulation, which was really eye-opening for me. I was the only non-American person there at the time. It was just before the election, so Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, so that was interesting times, and started looking at, well, how can we, so I was learning more about the signs and the symptoms, and so came back from there really fired up with energy and developed a pro forma so that we started asking more proactively about strangulation for everybody coming through. If they gave a history of it, and often they'd say choking or headlock, you know, they wouldn't say, oh, and I'm a victim of non-fatal strangulation. Those weren't terms they were using. So you had to switch your ears on. Then I devised this much more in-depth pro forma so that we could really start pulling what were the symptoms that they experienced, how long did it go on for, what was the mechanism, and then what signs did they have. And then I also established a strangulation working group, so multi-agency, because I needed to involve the ENT surgeons, so deciding which of these should be referred to ENT so that they could pass like a little camera and have a look for any internal injuries. We had police, we had CPS, we had probation, radiology, pathology, just to start thinking, well, what should we be doing? What are we doing? And it really grew from that. And meanwhile, sort of in parallel, I started collating all the data that was coming through at St. Mary's. So this, you know, every time we had a case, I would be extracting all the data in almost real time and creating this big database, which I've then gone on to, you know, publish a paper trying to educate the wider community, speaking about it, you know, speaking to lawyers, etc., what were their experience with it? Because when you speak to these people who are reporting strangulation, it's very, very different to a slap or a kick or a punch. So one of the things that we were doing was we were asking open questions. What were you thinking at the time? And 36.6%, so over a third, with that open question, are saying they thought they were going to die. You know, a lot would have been fairly close to death as well. And so it's, for me, listening to them, listening to the psychological terror that a lot, not all of them, but that a lot of them describe, it has to be treated differently. Now, they're not all the same, the people coming through, and the you know, suspects are not all the same, and the use of strangulation is not all the same. So for some, it would be, you know, very much hands around the neck until they couldn't breathe, they lost consciousness. For others, particularly in a domestic abuse setting where it happened before, it was sometimes all it needed was a hand on the neck. And the person would say, I froze, because I know from experience, if I struggle, he'll do it harder. So it's a complete control mechanism. So, and those are important things to consider, because if it's just the hands on the neck with perhaps a little squeeze, like a little warning squeeze, then you're not going to see any signs, you're not going to see any injury, and equally there may not be any injury with the alleged rape that accompanies it, because they are completely submissive to what is going on. Others give a different account. You know, I thought I was going to die, and I thought, well, if I'm going to die, I'm going to leave some marks on him. So they might have, you know, fought back a little bit and scratched, etc. So very different. But I suppose a big thing that struck me was the psychological element to this near-death experience. And I don't know whether you've ever had a near-death experience, but you know, I've had a couple, usually involving me not thinking very well and running across the road and twice nearly being hit by a bus. And I can still it can send, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck standing on end because I know I was that close. And so, you know, when we started having these conversations with CPS, that there was one particular case where in the early days they thought, right, well, we'll charge him with strangulation. This was an ex-partner who I think had broken into the house, had raped her, and then after the rape, he strangled her. And he strangled her until she lost consciousness and until she wet herself. And, you know, for any pathologists out there, they'll know that that is very much a near-fatal event. And then he left. But because he strangled her after the rape, Section 21 of the Offences Against the Person Act couldn't be used because he didn't do it in order to commit another crime, which just seems bonkers.
Yes, yes, it does. My sound is playing up there. Just going to... Yeah, that's better. Can you still hear me?
Yep.
It does seem totally, totally bonkers. And one of the things I really wanted to ask you about was, what about the idea, you know, people have read 50 Shades of Grey. I can't say that I got more than about 3 pages. It's so badly written, but that says probably more about me than anybody else. And that whole idea of, you know, rough horseplay, it used to be called in the old cases, that, and that consent issue that would often be raised. And I'm thinking about cases that I have prosecuted and defended in. And I mean, I know you and I know the work you've been doing. So alarm bells used to run for me when, if I was doing a case where I saw strangulation, or even if I was defending a case where, you know, you're reading the papers and then listening to, strangulation, look to see if there's a history and so on. So my question is really this, that can it be a one-off, and can you have this rough horseplay, near-death experiences? I can't see the attraction myself, but can it be a one-off, or is it always a case, looking at the statistical evidence, that they end up in death?
Well, of course, you know, you can't legislate, or perhaps you can, but you probably shouldn't, for people's personal lives, can you? And everybody will be different. So I'm sure that in some cases there is a context of some consensual activity involving that. But that's where you need to take each case on its own merits, don't you? And the police, you know, the first responders, whether that's A&E, whether that's the police, whether it's us here at SARC, need to be considering, well, what might the context of this be? So, you know, 14% of the cases were strangers. So this is, you know, obviously the people we're seeing, it's all in the, you know, as one element of a sexual assault or alleged sexual assault. So, you know, perhaps some people do meet a stranger walking down the road and decide that they want to have sex with them and be strangled by this person and they don't even know the name. That may happen, doesn't seem very likely to me. In the domestic abuse arena, you know, where it's a partner, ex-partner, we would always be doing a DASH, you know, doing the risk assessment for domestic abuse. Now, you will know that any score over 14 is considered high risk. Yeah. In these cases, the average score was 15. If you look at it in that context, it doesn't seem very likely that it was part of, you know, particularly if there's, you know, they arrive and they've got black eyes and bruises and this and that. So you have to explore. I suppose you have to consider, well, what might a possible defence be, rightly or wrongly, and we're not the investigators and we're not the decision makers, but we have to assist those people by gathering accurate, independent information that can let other people then decide. So, of course, there will be some cases where it's part of consensual activity that, but then why are they in front of us if that's the case? I don't know. But for a lot, you know, my gut feeling, and it's my gut feeling is based on however many decades of experience doing this, is that there's a lot where it is not consensual. And that, again, is another important part, because I think with, you'll know better than me, juries sometimes struggle, don't they, with the sexual element. Well, it's an issue of consent. Whereas I think if you have somebody who also gives a history of strangulation, I think it's easier for some of the complainants to continue with the case, perhaps because of there's less stigma, I don't know, than a sexual assault. But it might be easier for jury members to swallow as well, particularly if there are injuries. Now, in our study, which looked at 3 years worth of cases, so we had 204 adults, less than 50% had an injury on their neck and head attributable to the strangulation. But that fits in, you know, there's a study looking at 78 women who have been killed by strangulation, and only 20% of those, you know, 20% have no external sign of strangulation, they're dead.
I mean, I think we need to move away, because we know, don't we, even in sexual offences, that jurors look, and we are all guilty of it as advocates, of asking about injury. The whole injury, invisible injury thing is misleading, isn't it? Because actually, that 20% of women killed, only those had injuries. I mean, that's very low. And yet, it's very expectant, isn't it? When you look at the evidence, you know, looking at injuries.
Yeah.
So much time on it, you know, say, well, where are the injuries?
Yeah. And I think there's other things, you know, so we need to be asking about things like loss of consciousness and incontinence. Now, I don't think we've ever had someone arrive and say, oh, and by the way, I lost consciousness, and oh, by the way, I was incontinent of urine. They won't tell you unless you ask them. And I don't know why that is. I don't know whether it's embarrassment or they don't, particularly the incontinence, they think perhaps that was fear. I don't know why. But, you know, we had 1 in 6 lost consciousness. And you really, that's a really important part of this, because, you know, that speaks towards intent.
Yes.
Because the, you know, studies back in the 1940s on adult males and controlled surroundings, the average time to loss of consciousness was 6.8 seconds. The average time to be incontinent of urine was about 30 seconds. So you think, well, that's a lot of time, you know, that needs to get carry on. Sorry, incontinence was about 15 seconds, feces was 30 seconds. So that's important in so much as, okay, so you weren't intending to hurt her, but you had your hands around her neck. She was no longer responsive, and you kept going, and you kept going until, you know, she wet herself or until she was incontinent of feces. That seems least reckless, if nothing else.
Absolutely. And that is a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, one of these stark things, and it still stays with me, was when you were doing a presentation, maybe in the, when I spoke at the conference, maybe it was St. Mary's conferences on sexual assault, but a video that you showed, which was of wrestling. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
I think when we do the lectures, you'll have to show us again.
Yes.
In our seminars. But that stayed with me because the chap, it was, you know, an attempt to show what happens when somebody's being strangled by two wrestlers and blanking out, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it wasn't that long. That's what I found astonishing, actually.
Yeah.
Imagine, I think, that we think about strangulation, even now under this bill, that non-fatal strangulation is going to be, you know, a long time, there'll be lots of injuries and so on. But it's not. It's actually not that long before you pass out and lose consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, with him, he was in a headlock, wasn't he, by one of the WWF. And he was all wired up so that they could see his physiological response. But when he came to, he didn't know that he'd been, choked out was the term he used, wasn't it? He wasn't sure whether it had happened. And again, I think that's a really important point you raise, Sally, because, you know, no oxygen means no memory. If your brain's not getting oxygen, then you are not, it's not that you forget things. You haven't recorded that information in the first place. And so they might not be the best historians. You know, they might not be able to give a chronological account of what's actually happened. And that might be a mixture, you know, extreme fear or just the lack of oxygen. So that's something, you know, which adds to the mix of, suppose, of the people trying to untangle, well, what has or hasn't happened, you know, say in a courtroom. But it is important to bear in mind that they may not, it's very likely actually that they won't be able to give a very clear account. One of the questions we ask is, how long do you think it went on for? Now, a lot just can't answer that question at all. Or they, you know, quite a few give ridiculous amounts of time where you think, well, that hasn't happened because you would be dead if that happened. But I suppose time just gets completely distorted, doesn't it, when you are in a very stressed situation.
Yes, it does. And, you know, as you were saying, I can recall lots of cases where the complainants, you know, the answers they give are ridiculous, and the accounts, you know, we say the accounts have got problems. But actually, if they have no memory, they're often trying to piece things together. And, you know, and if there's been, you know, a bit of alcohol consumption there, you know, we put it down to, well, they must have been drunk because they can't remember. You know, an occasion substance abuse, put it down to those other factors. But the reality is, which is interesting, that actually the accounts are not particularly great because they've had a loss of oxygen and they're trying to... So what do you think about this, the new bill, as it were? And I saw that the past Victims Commissioner, Baroness Newlove, had championed it through the Lords, and there were several peers who were also supportive. And the present Victim Commissioner, of course, was Barrister Dame Vera Beard QC, as being one of the champions. What do you think about the Act? And are you pleased? Is it quite, of the bill as it still is it quite what you thought or envisaged? What will the Act do?
Well, I'm delighted because, you know, it's been something I've been speaking to everybody about, it, and it seemed like it was a bit of an uphill battle. Yes. So I was really pleased that, you know, it's got taken up. If it helps to raise the profile, that's great. I think one of the things, so New Zealand introduced the new law back in 2018, and their feedback from them, from New Zealand, has been just having the new bill, the new act on its own won't cut the mustard. Yeah. You've got to have awareness raising, you've got to have the training, you've got to have the clinicians gathering the information. So other things need to happen alongside the bill, otherwise it just won't be able to do it. And the other big gap I feel, and I've been saying this since 2016, is we know that a lot of the victims of non-fatal strangulation will be in the domestic abuse arena.
Yes.
At SARC, Sexual Assault Referral Centre, so we see people if they've been strangled as part of a sexual assault or allegation of a sexual assault. What's going to happen to all those people who've been strangled but haven't also been sexually assaulted as part of that? Where do they go? And they go either to a GP who, as you know, has a 10-minute appointment and doesn't have any forensic training, or they go to A&E, and A&E have a different remit. You know, they're busy and they are to keep people alive. They're not there to collect a load of forensic information, detailed history, etc. So I think that there's a big gap that needs to be addressed. That at the moment, there doesn't seem to be a massive appetite to address that gap.
Well, do you think, I mean, as we record this, has been the awful murder of Sarah Everand. and it's the weekend following women's demonstrations against the use of violence. And I wonder if there might be a better appetite now to look globally at violence against women, non-fatal strangulation, and look at the steps to be taken. Because you're right, it's like FGM. You know, just having the act does not stop it. And in a whole load of other factors, which is a wider topic than this particular episode of the podcast, but, you know, you do need, and we do need, all the factors in the system, aside from the law and the criminal justice system. But I just wondered if you thought maybe this was the time, maybe enough is enough, and maybe now is the time for the appetite, really.
Well, I hope so, Sally. I really hope so. Things like longer sentences, okay. I'm not sure whether, is there any evidence that longer sentences prevent, you know, anybody else doing anything? But also, how many actually get there to that conviction in court? And we know, don't we, that there's so much that needs to be done way, way before that. And there's so many elements to this. You know, we're talking extremes here with strangulation and rape, aren't we? Terrible though they are. But there's all that low level. There's the gender pay gap. There's a look at women in society. How many blockbuster films pass the Bechdel test? I mean, I know that's improving. There's so many elements that are needed to empower women. And I know men are victims, but the vast majority, women or girls, and the overwhelmingly the offenders, men. And so let's not just talk about, yeah, we've lengthened a couple of sentences, job done, because it's so much more than that. You know, we've watched the COVID presentations every evening, haven't we? And how many have been presented by women?
I know.
You know, Black Lives Matter, you know, football, you can have it on the stands, Black Lives Matter. What does that actually mean? It's meaningless if it doesn't translate into real action. And that's got to be done way before somebody becomes an offender. You know, it's too late once they're an offender. You know what it's like for attitudes. If you're recruiting staff, you know, recruit for attitude, you train for skill. It's too late once those attitudes are embedded. It's very hard to change, isn't it? So we have to go massively upstream. And, you know, there's all these reviews about rape, aren't there? But nobody seems to be, like, completely grabbing it and owning the whole process. You know, they'll have a CPS review, but actually, you know, the forensic element, you know, they just might have us in a workshop for half an hour and ask us a few questions. There's not that complete overview of what's happening. And I think it needs to be much more fundamental to make a real impact.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, I often defend a lot of people. I defend a lot of people, but, you know, young men as well as older men. And I agree that I do feel that when they get to me and I'm representing, it is too late. Because, you know, we've got to the stage, there's been no interventions much earlier on to reduce that. So I really understand what you're saying and where you're coming from. I wonder, just before you go, you travel a lot internationally, you know, as a leading expert, not just on this subject, but as a doctorate in many areas, going to America and indeed Texas, which is one of my favourite stories of you being over there. And I just wondered how you've been managing without your global travel, given we've been stuck in the pandemic for the last 12 months.
Yeah, it's not been too bad. Gives me a bit more time at home. You know, I've done quite a bit for the UN, and the most recent UN thing they wanted me to do was Afghanistan. So considering what's going on over there, I'm not the bravest of people, so I'm actually a little bit relieved that I'm not traveling off to Afghanistan. So yeah, it makes you reflect and realize how lucky I've been to be able to travel now that, you know, it's not an option at the moment, is it? I have been incredibly lucky
all round. Yes, quite. Well, Dr. Kath White, thank you so much for coming on the Law and Guidance podcast. If you'd like to find out more about the work and the expertise of St. Mary's SARC, you can visit the the centre, but also we're holding a series of lectures looking specifically at strangulation, where I will be talking about the law and Dr. White will be talking about the law in practical terms of what strangulation actually means. So do feel free to join us and catch that webinar again. But for now, thank you so much, Dr. White, for joining me on this podcast.
Thanks for asking me, Sally.